Andy Crane in the Cat's Whiskers studio.
Hi, welcome to this week's programme. How's your week been?
A good one, I trust. Mine was fine, thank you. And I haven't bitten my fingernails at all yet. It's been difficult, but I haven't bitten my fingernails at all yet. How are you doing with your New Year's resolutions? I hope they're coming on as well as mine are. I've spent most of the week going through the postbag, reading some of your letters. As interesting as ever. Thank you very much indeed for those. A lot of letters about Marlene Marlowe. I'm glad you like her. I shall pass on your regards to her. And we also found in the postbag, look, I must read this for you. We got a letter from Dr. Pete, who you may remember has gone off to Nepal exploring. He says, "Dear Cat's Whiskers, flew into Nepal at sunrise yesterday and saw the whole range of the Himalayas from Annapurna in the east to Mount Everest in the west." He says, "It's great to be back in ancient Kathmandu. Final preparations today of all the rafts and the jungle gear for the expedition. We leave tomorrow for the remote West Nepal area, where I'll be seeing sick people and revisiting the clinic I helped set up 1 year ago." How exciting. He's also promised to keep in touch with us. And I, of course, am looking forward to hearing his recordings when he comes back from Nepal. But more of that on Dr. Pete's return. Tonight on the programme, we have part two of The Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall, featuring Marlene Marlowe. Four of your snow poems. We've had loads of those. Thank you so much for them. I'll be reading out four of them tonight. We've also details, as promised last week, of the Fast Forward Fiction Award. Your chance to win a trip for yourself and your family to no less than Disney World in Florida. Details later. And we've episode two of The Call of the Wild. Letters about Marlene Marlowe. What ideas did you come up with after last week's episode? Well, John David Smith says, "I think the stone-cold man was turned to stone by the monster." Christina Ingram from the West Midlands says, "The beast is haunting Harold to frighten him to death so his cousin Camilla could inherit his wealth." And Keen Selina and Eleanor McGarvey both think that Marlene found a garden gnome. Maybe you will have some ideas after tonight's episode of The Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall.
I knelt beside the stone-cold body of the bearded man in the pointed hat. In the dim moonlight, his contorted face seemed to be twisted into a gruesome smile. My legs turned to jelly. Then my ankles turned to custard, and my feet turned to blancmange. After what seemed to be about a week, Harold and his cousin, Miss Camilla de Courcy, came running up.
Marlene, what is it? What's that object behind you?
No, Harold, don't look. It's too awful. But before I could restrain him, Harold had spotted the body.
No, it's not too awful. It's Eric.
You recognise him?
Well, I should jolly well think so. I dragged him out of the way under the bushes here once I'd done with him, don't you know? Well, a chap can hardly have an ugly blighter like Eric cluttering up one's front lawn. Good work.
You have hidden talents, cousin dear.
You mean, Harold, that you had some part in poor Eric's grisly death?
I say, do hold on. He can't have died.
He has, horribly. He's stone-cold dead.
No, he's stone-cold gnome. Eric's my giant garden gnome, don't you know?
Garden gnome? Called Eric?
It's his gnome de plume.
What's his real name, then?
Gnome de plume.
Silence!
Silence? That's a funny name.
I mean, silence, be quiet, you fool. I thought I heard a movement in the bushes.
Is it the beast of Puddlethorpe Hall?
It must be. The ugly monster dares to confront us at last.
You won't try to tackle it?
Of course I will. A huge, ugly black shape loomed up out of the darkness of the bushes. It was more hideous than the Incredible Hulk, more terrible than Mr. T, and more thunderous than Mrs. T. With one great stride, it stood in front of me, towering down. I pulled my weapon from my pocket and squeezed my rubber duck.
Marlene, you pathetic specimen of a private detective, you!
Auntie! I should have realized. There's only one person in the whole of the universe who's more hideous than the Incredible Hulk, more terrible than Mr. T, and more thunderous than Mrs. T. My Aunt Maud.
What do you think you're playing at?
I'm investigating a case, Auntie.
Investigating a case? If anything in this blooming town needs investigating, Marlene Marlowe, it's your head.
Why aren't you at the Pier Pavilion producing Puddlethorpe's popular pantomime, Puss in Plimsolls, Auntie?
Haven't you heard? Puss has pushed off. Wayne John, you know, the actor who plays Puss, has just disappeared.
Well.
I say, can't we go back to the hall? It's awfully spooky out here.
On the way back to the house, I told Aunt Maud all about the beast of Puddlethorpe Hall. We had just got to the back door when Harold suddenly said...
What did you say, Harold? Yes, I thought you did.
Marks on the door. Hideous claw and teeth marks.
You know what these marks mean?
Yes, Harold will need a new door.
No, I mean, we've had a visitor. A dreadful, creepy visitor. The beast of Puddlethorpe Hall. It is obvious that this beast is enormous and hungry. If it got into the hall, Harold, it would probably eat you alive, crushing every one of your bones between its monstrous fangs.
It might not eat him.
Oh?
Not if it's a vegetarian beast.
If it's a vegetarian beast, it'll eat you, Marlene Marlowe, instead.
Why is that, Auntie?
Because you're a turnip head.
Harold, there's only one thing to do. You must evacuate Puddlethorpe Hall.
Good idea. I'll lend you my vacuum cleaner.
Evacuate, not vacuum.
There was nothing more to be done that night. As I drove back down the hill towards Puddlethorpe, dawn was already appearing over the horizon. I never realized her early morning paper round took her this far out. Back in my flat, I managed to snatch a few hours' sleep before I was woken by Aunt Maud hammering at the door.
Ah, Marlene! Glad you're up and awake. You know, Marlene, I think there's something very fishy going on.
Yes, sorry, Auntie, it's my socks. I'm just pulling them over my feet.
No, you pea-brained private eye. I mean with this beast of Puddlethorpe Hall business.
Oh.
I think we'd do well to follow Harold and Camilla.
Good idea, Auntie.
We'll toss. Heads, you follow Camilla. Tails, I'll follow Harold.
I walked back out of town and up the hill to Puddlethorpe Hall. Camilla's silver Porsche was parked outside the front door. I undid the door and slipped into the back. I laid down and pulled a rug over me. It wasn't long before Camilla opened the car door. I peered out from under the rug. I could see that she had three large suitcases under her arms. And then I could see that I had three large suitcases on my head. As the car pulled away, a weird sound filled my ear.
I know you're gonna dig this.
It was Camilla's in-car sound system. I took the speaker out of my ear. We careered back down the hill, into Puddlethorpe, and along towards the marina. Suddenly, there was a screech of brakes. My private detective's brain told me it could mean only one thing. We had stopped. Camilla grabbed two of the suitcases. I peered out and saw her toss them onto a small speedboat that was moored alongside us. Then she came back, grabbed the third suitcase, and tossed it into the speedboat. She came back again, grabbed the fourth suitcase, and it was then that I realized that there wasn't a fourth suitcase.
Put me down, Camilla! I'm not a suitcase!
No, Marlene Marlowe, but you are a nutcase!
No sooner had I landed in the speedboat than Camilla jumped in after me. She started the engine and we roared out to sea.
How would you like a rest, Marlene?
Oh, that would be very nice, Camilla.
Well, why don't you go and lie down on the bed? The sea bed!
Camilla spun the wheel furiously, and the boat lurched to one side. It was then that it suddenly struck me. The water, that is.
Ah! Nobody comes between me and my plans. Not even you, Marlene Marlowe, you dithering dolt-head of a detective. Bye-bye!
Suddenly, I had that sinking feeling. The sort of sinking feeling you get when you're out at sea and you can't swim. As the icy waters lapped about my ears, I tried desperately to think how I could keep myself afloat and how I could attract the attention of people on the shore. All I had on me was my clothes, a bar of soap, and a rubber duck in my pocket. It looked as if the career of Marlene Marlowe, private detective, was definitely taking a dive.
Well, lots to think about this week. How can Marlene escape from the likelihood of a watery grave? And what exactly are Camilla's plans, do you think? Well, if you've got any ideas, do feel free to drop us a line, and the address will be coming up after the programme. In our Christmas programme, you may remember that we played you this piece of music and asked you to write a snow poem inspired by it. Well, we received sackloads. Thank you very much indeed if you sent us a poem. It was very difficult to pick out ones to read out, but these are the four that we chose. The first from Cecilia Evans. The sky lays a blanket on the ground, crisp and light, shiny and white. And cuddling the houses, it looks as though the city is a cake, frosted with sugar. This one's from Christopher Lunny. Snowflakes fluttering, fluttering down, drowning, drowning, drowning the town. Glittering, glittering white as sheep, covering the houses while they sleep. And from Suzanne Forks. Snow is white, snow is cold. Snow is like little white holes, flutter, flutter, down it goes. Snow is like marigolds of white. Look at it going down below. Drift, drift, it falls. Now the snow is icy cold water. Cold, slippery and wet. And finally from Francis Williams. Snow swirling like talc. Flakes fall, forming a thick blanket. The smoke twirling through the snow, the bell muffled. The cries as the street sellers walk through the town, the snow piling against the arches, the snow covering the hill scarred with the tracks of many sledges. The men of the snow standing still as they sink slowly to the ground. Thank you very much indeed to you four. You will be receiving your picture puffin books of the Snow Queen. Now, it would seem from your letters to the Cat's Whiskers office and the number of entries that we had to our snow poems competition that you really like writing, which is good. It's especially good if you like writing stories, because this week we have a brilliant competition for you. The Fast Forward Fiction Award gives you the chance to win a trip for yourself and your family to no less than Disney World in Florida, just for writing a story. Details of how to enter the competition a little later on in the programme. First, we thought we'd give you some tips on how to be an author. And this week joining me is Jill Murphy. Now, Jill Murphy has written loads of books, but she's best known for her Worst Witch stories. Jill, thanks for joining us. If you're presented with a blank piece of paper and you have to write a story, where on earth do you start?
It's very difficult, actually, when people ask you about inspiration and where you get it from, because it's a sort of magic, really. It's like a light bulb appearing above your head in comics, you know. And you either get it or you don't. You know, sometimes, you know, you write a really good story, and sometimes it's just so feeble that you throw it away and start again. I think it's probably the same for children and grown-up writers, really.
Do you write every day, Jill? I know authors go in and say, I must sit down and write 400 words before lunch or something like that. Do you write every day?
No, I don't. In fact, I'm a very naughty illustrator and writer, really. It's not the way I work. I know that some writers really do. They sit down, as you say, they sit down at 9 o'clock in the morning and turn all the phones off and get on with it. But I don't. I have to have a really good story to tell.
It sounds to me like you would sit down with a very definite idea of where the story was going to go. Is that the case?
Yes, otherwise I can't do it. I mean, it just doesn't happen if you haven't got a pretty good plot. It's a plot, really. You have to have a good plot. The other thing is, it doesn't always come to you sitting at a desk. Usually, in my case, I'm on a bus, or in fact, I've just started writing some stories recently for 11-year-olds, and I wrote most of them at a swimming pool one afternoon when I was with a lot of children.
Do you rewrite things? Do you read it back to yourself and say, oh, that's no good, I'm going to change that?
Yes, sometimes I do. I do, yes. I think you should always look through anyway, and I'm very grim about spelling. You know, I like to make sure it all looks well presented for the poor publishers who have to read it. But, for example, with The Worst Witch, which I wrote when I was 18, in fact, I started to write it when I was 15, it's in all my school rough books with little drawings of her. And I finished the manuscript when I was 18, and that was exactly how it was published when I was 24. Nobody even edited it. The reason I wrote The Worst Witch, as I'm sure a lot of people who went to rather grim schools can see, is that it's really the story of my first term at a rather posh grammar school, where I was a misfit and couldn't cope with anything. And my mother used to say, look at you, you look like a little witch, when I came home, because we were in this black school uniform. And so I thought, rather than make them into ordinary children, it'd be much more fun if they were witches, just a light bulb of an idea, because it is fun, isn't it? Imagine going to school, You know, imagine going to school and instead of bicycles, you zoom over the wall on broomsticks and, you know, and also I used to love animals, I still do. And I thought, gosh, supposing if you all had a cat sitting on the back of your chair, and also if you had a row with somebody really horrid, like this girl who I won't tell you who she was, in case you meet her grown up. You could have a fantastic row with her and turn her into, well, a frog or a pig, by
mistake.
That would
be wonderful, wouldn't it?
Great, wouldn't it?
That would be a wonderful idea. Can I talk to you briefly about the most difficult part I found when writing essays in English at school?
Yes.
The ending, Jill. How do I avoid the I woke up and it had all been a dream cliché at the end?
Well, you just have to make sure you avoid it. Whatever you do, avoid it, because I'm there again from the point of view of budding writers. Now, I've actually made it as a writer, and I have a lot of school reports saying the endings are weak. You know, I can remember that was all criticism. Ending is weak. They used to write in a lot of my essays because, as you just say, you get bored or you think, oh, I just can't think what to do. Well, you have to be the one that's just that bit different. Just be a little bit more original than everyone else and, you know, and perhaps not end it in a conventional way. End it slightly up in the air and leave your audience wondering what happens next, that sort of thing. Yeah, another little bit of advice too is to keep a diary. And it's very good for you to actually have to try and make interesting a normal, boring day. Got up, washed hair, went out, went to the shops. You know, you've got to make it a bit better than that.
Good practice, then.
Yes, very good practice. And I think keeping a diary is very good discipline to do that every single day and try and make it sound a little bit more interesting than it should be.
Good advice from a lady who knows. Thank you, Jill. Hopefully she will have inspired you to write a good story for the Fast Forward Fiction Award. And never fear if inspiration has not struck you yet, because next week I'll be speaking to another well-known author, Dick King-Smith, and he's written books that you may have read, The Sheep Pig, Hodgehead, and more recently, George Speaks. For full details of the Fast Forward Fiction Award, write to us here at Cat's Whiskers. The address is coming up after the programme. Birthday list coming up very shortly, but first somebody for you to meet. Do you remember when we auctioned a day in the Cat's Whiskers studio for children in need? Well, joining me now is Eve Kelly. Hello.
Hello.
And you're going to help me with the birthday list this week, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
But first, as you know, we need to pick some music from our Pulitzer. So, I'll give you the choice. What word should I put in the Pulitzer this week?
Disney, please.
Disney it shall be then. Hang on a second. D-I-S... Where's N? There it is. N-E... Why? And we'll see what music our Pulitzer comes up with.
The wonderful thing about Tiggers is Tiggers are wonderful things. Their tops are made out of rubber. Their bottoms are made out of springs. They're bouncy, trouncy, flouncy, bouncy, fun, 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 fun. But the most wonderful thing about Tiggers is I'm the only one.
Happy birthday to club members celebrating birthdays this week who are James Helm, Thomas Morton, Benjamin Perkins, Alice Lawler and William Baker.
Simon Greaves, David Lilburn, Elizabeth Adams, Barnaby Hutchins.
Alexander Turner, Daniel Morell, Sarah Garfoot, George Richards and Leela Strulger.
Claire Hams, Gemma Wilkinson, Kathy Morton, Elizabeth Wigg.
Happy birthday to Joe O'Neill, to Edward Ray Allison, to Rachel Holly, to Flora Eloise and to Charlotte Dawes.
Sam Dobby, Louise Reynolds, Nicholas Henry, Kevin Wilkinson.
Henry and Sydney Florence, Bethan Ellis, David Ossack and Rosamond Sears.
Imogen Bloomfield, William Skeepin, Philip Urell, Oliver Nash.
Seema Raghunathan, Kate Leckie, Alex Watson, Marie Louise Hilton and Emma Hodinett.
Damon Granger, Christopher Willey, Richard Smith, Joanna Ward.
And finally, Tom Hill, Emma Weissel, Jennifer Hobbs, and Alison Walker.
They're bouncy, bouncy, flouncy, flouncy, fun, 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 fun. But the most wonderful thing about Tiggers is I'm the only one. Oh, I'm the only one.
Now, as you remember last week, we now send a T-shirt every week to one lucky club member, so we'll ask the Pulitzer to pick out a club member's number. One... 4, 7, 2, 4, 3. And that is the number of Alexander Turner, who is 10 on the 18th of January. Happy birthday to you, Alexander. A T-shirt in the post to you. And you may be interested to know that you share your birthday with David Bellamy and Raymond Briggs, who wrote all those brilliant stories like The Snowman and Fungus the Bogeyman and Grandad 2. Also celebrating birthdays this week are Pete Waterman, Richard Briers, Stefan Edberg and Dennis Taylor, the snooker player. Time now for episode 2 of our serial, The Call of the Wild. Episode 2 is called The Fight for Leadership.
Perrault was in a hurry. The Canadian government courier was carrying urgent dispatches to the Klondike. For the first few days, the dogs had made good time over the packed snow of a well-used trail, but now over fresh snow, progress with the sled was often slow and always difficult. Buck was rapidly adjusting to the life of a sled dog, and his Californian home was little more than a dim memory. His main problem was Spitz. The lead dog, seeing Buck as a dangerous rival, never lost an opportunity of bullying him and constantly tried to start a fight. One evening, driving snow and a biting wind had forced them to grope for a camping place by a lake. Buck dug a warm nest, then went to get his ration of fish. On his return, he found his nest occupied, and a warning snarl told him that his trespasser was Spitz. Till now, Buck had avoided trouble, but this was too much. In fury, he sprang upon Spitz, and the two dogs shot out of the disputed nest. Then, the unexpected happened. 100 or so starving huskies from a nearby Indian village had scented the camp and crept in. There was a thwack of a club, a shrill yelp of pain, and pandemonium broke out. Perrault and Francois the driver sprang among them with stout clubs as they overturned the grub box. Meanwhile, more of the fierce invaders set upon the team dogs. Although they fought back courageously, there was no opposing these hunger-maddened dogs. Billy, terrified into bravery, sprang through the encircling mass of huskies and fled away over the ice. Pike and Dub followed, with the rest of the team behind. As Buck went to spring after them, Spitz charged with the treacherous intention of overthrowing him. Buck braced himself against the charge, then joined the fleeing dogs on the lake. Later, the 9 sled dogs sought shelter in the forest. There was not one who was not wounded. At daybreak, they limped warily back to camp to find the marauders, as well as half their grub supply, gone. The huskies had chewed through everything that was remotely eatable, including the harness and even Francois's whip. 2 hours of cursing and exertion got the harness into shape, and the wound-stiffened team was underway, struggling painfully over the hardest part of the trail between them and Dawson Town. The river ice bent and crackled underfoot, and they dared not halt. In 6 days of exhausting toil, they covered only 30 terrible miles. By the time they reached good ice, the dogs were played out. The Perrault, to make up lost time, continued to push them. Buck now openly threatened Spitz's leadership and encouraged a general insubordination amongst the other dogs. But despite continual quarreling and strife, they pulled into Dawson one dreary afternoon with the great fight still to come. Here were countless dogs, mainly the wild husky breed. All day they swung up and down the main street in long teams, and every night they lifted a weird and eerie chant in which it was Buck's delight to join. 7 days later, they set off on the return trip, with even more urgent dispatches. One night after supper, Dub flushed a rabbit, and in a second the whole team was in full cry. 50 huskies from a nearby police camp joined the chase. The rabbit raced down the icy bed of the river and then turned to follow the course of a frozen stream. Buck led the pack around bend after bend, but he could not gain. Always a rabbit fled swiftly before him in the moonlight. Spitz cunningly left the pack and cut across a narrow neck of land where the stream made a long bend around. As Buck rounded the bend, Spitz leapt into the immediate path of the rabbit. At the sound of its death shriek, the pack raised howls of delight. Buck did not cry out. He did not check himself, but drove in hard upon Spitz, shoulder to shoulder. The two dogs rolled over and over in the powdery snow. In a flash, Buck knew it. The time had come. It was to the death. The other dogs drew up silently, expectantly around them, their eyes gleaming. There was not the faintest whisper of air. Not a leaf quivered. The visible breaths of the dogs drifted slowly upward in the frosty air. Spitz was a practiced fighter. Wherever Buck's fangs struck, they were countered by the fangs of Spitz. He enveloped Spitz in a whirlwind of rushes, but every time Spitz gashed him and got away. Buck then took to rushing, as though for the throat, but at the last minute would drive at the shoulder of Spitz in an attempt to overthrow him. The fight was growing desperate. All the while, a silent, wolfish circle waited to finish off whichever dog went down. Spitz now started rushing and kept Buck staggering for footing. Once he went over, and the whole circle of dogs started up. But he recovered himself, and the circle sank down again and waited. But Buck could also fight with imagination. He rushed as though attempting the old shoulder trick, but at the last instant swept low to the snow and in. His teeth closed on Spitz's left foreleg. There was a crunch of breaking bone, and a white dog faced him on three legs. Three times Buck tried to knock him over, then repeated the trick and broke the right foreleg. Despite the pain and helplessness, Spitz struggled madly to stay up. The circle closed in. Every animal was motionless, half crouching for the spring, its eyes fixed on Spitz as he staggered back and forth, snarling with horrible menace, as though to frighten off impending death. Then Buck sprang in and out. Shoulder at last squarely met shoulder. The dark circle of dogs became a dot on the moon-flooded snow as Spitz disappeared from view. Next morning, when they discovered Spitz missing, the two men guessed the truth. The dog driver proceeded to harness the dogs. He brought Sol Lex up to Spitz's place as lead dog, only to find Buck already standing there. Francois slapped his thighs gleefully.
"Look at that Buck," he cried. "Him kill that Spitz. Him think to take the job."
Perrault simply shrugged. Francois, grinning broadly, put Sol Lex back in his old place and harnessed Buck at the head of the team. They set off. Buck immediately took up the duties of leadership. The team had grown unruly during the last days of Spitz, but Buck now began to lick them into shape and the old-time solidarity returned. At Rink Rapids, two native huskies, Teak and Kuna, were added, and the speed with which Buck broke them in took Francois's breath.
"Never such a dog as that Buck," he cried. "Eh? What you say, Perrault?"
Perrault just nodded.
Find out how Buck gets on now he's the team leader in episode 3 of Call of the Wild next week, The Toil of Track and Trail. Also next week, we've part 3 of The Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall, our Marlene Marlowe mystery, the results of the New Year's birthday quiz, and I'll be meeting some dinosaurs alive here in Manchester. More of that next week. Until then, my thanks to you for listening. Join me next Sunday about the same time.
The Cat's Whiskers address is Cat's Whiskers, BBC, P.O. Box 40, Manchester, M60, 1FZ. And Cat's Whiskers was presented by Andy Crane. Marlene Marlowe and the Beast of Puddlethorpe Hall was written by Roy Apps, The Call of the Wild by Jack London was abridged by Mick Greenway and read by Bob Peck. Others taking part were Anne Rosenfeld, Marlene Sidaway, Charles Simpson and John Ball. The researcher was Liz Roberts, and the programme was produced in Manchester by Mary Callum-Carrion.